Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. On a recent National Roads and Bridges report card, Ohio scored a C-, just a bit better than the D-plus awarded the nation overall by the American Society of Civil Engineers. Neither grade is cause for bragging. Joining us now to talk about that from the American Society of Engineers is Kevin Carpenter. He's a co-owner at Carpenter Marty Transportation, which designs roads and bridges for the state of Ohio. He also serves on the Board of Zoning and Planning for the city of Upper Arlington, where he lives. Kevin Carpenter, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I said that Ohio scored a C- nationally. What does that mean to the average person when you say C-, or is that just something that industry people get?
No, I think we the grade is kind of hard to understand because we tried to give it a grade that reflects really the conditions of the bridges in Ohio. Ohio is kind of unique because the national standards for a bridge basically says a bridge is anything that's over 20 feet in span, whereas Ohio rates anything over 10 feet in span. The national code says you have to inspect bridges every 2 years, whereas Ohio inspects them every year. So we do things a little bit different in Ohio, which actually helped our grade because we are very active in inspecting our bridges and maintaining them. But that means we have a lot more bridges. We have 44,000 bridges in Ohio. And of those, about 7.5% are deemed as structurally deficient, which means basically they have some lesser carrying capacity than they should. So, for example, if you design a bridge to carry 100 pounds, it basically is deficient in some characteristics so that it can only carry 90 pounds, for example. So it basically limits the capacity of that bridge to carry what it should. And then the other thing we look at is it functionally obsolete? So basically, does it meet the current design criteria? And so we've got a number of bridges that are functionally obsolete as well. So when you look at those two things together, Ohio has several thousand bridges that are either structurally deficient or functionally obsolete. And so that doesn't mean they're not safe. It just means that they don't meet current criteria or they have some deficiency in them. So basically the C- is like you said, better than the national grade, but it's still not where it should be. With that many bridges that are either structurally deficient or functionally obsolete, there's a lot of need to replace those or do significant rehabilitation to those to get them to be where they should be.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Kevin Carpenter. We're talking about the report card that the American Society of Civil Engineers gave the state of Ohio and the rest of the states and the nation as a whole. Ohio scored a C-. We're talking about the condition of Ohio's roads and bridges. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You talked about different standards, the standards changing and they're not up to standard. How much does that 7%, roughly 7% of the bridges and roads, how much does that have to do with age?
A lot of it has to do with age. The national average for bridges in the country is 42 years. We design bridge basically for a design life of between 50 and 100 years. So a lot of the bridges that have been built are reaching the end of their life. And so a lot, even some of the bridges, we're replacing now are 75, even, older than that. They were built back in the work public administration back in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And so they've just reached the design life. And so it's just time to replace those. The problem is that there's so many of those bridges that were built, when the interstate system was originally started to be built in the 60s, that's 50 years ago. And so a lot of the bridges on the interstate, which carry most of the traffic, are reaching their design life and need to be replaced.
How much have the standards changed since the 30s?
Well,
how would we describe that?
It's changed tremendously. I mean, if you just think about the capacity for trucks and the weight of cars and the weight of freight that we move, and then the amount of vehicles that, were in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, and how many vehicles are on the road today. I was looking at a study that Texas A&M did on congestion. In 1982, the average Columbus resident faced about 4 hours of delay, traffic delay, over a year. In 2012, 30 years later, it was 40 hours a year that they averaged.
I believe
delay.
This.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's there's significantly more traffic on the roadway, and the capacity hasn't increased to be able to carry all that traffic. So it's really impeded our ability as a society to move goods and people from place to place, because there's just not that much room. There's a lot more traffic on the roadways, and so it just gets in the way and causes delays.
Ohio is sort of what some people have referred to as a pass-through state. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of people who travel through Ohio that don't stay in Ohio, so they're not necessarily paying gas tax in Ohio and that sort of thing. And then there's a lot of more wear and tear on our roads and bridges because of that. Ohio's not alone in that, but it is a really busy state for people to travel through. What impact, what part of the problem does that represent?
That's a significant problem. Most of the problem that's done on the roadways is the truck traffic, because they have obviously a lot more weight than the passenger vehicles do. You know, I think Ohio has the seventh most interstate roadway in the country. And the freight that's moved across Ohio that, like you say, doesn't originate here or end here causes a significant problem, because, like you say, they're not really paying for the roadway there. Now, a lot of the money for the national highway system comes from the federal government, mm-hmm. and Ohio gets about 58% of its funding from federal sources. So the money is being, you know, spent in Ohio, but it doesn't match what's needed, I guess.
If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. How much... The standards have changed a great deal. How much has the quality of the standards changed? In other words, the technology of the standards, the technology behind the standards, how much has that changed? Do we know more about the concrete we use? Do we know more about the pavement we use than we did 20 or 30 years ago even?
Yeah, absolutely. The standards have changed tremendously. The design standards, even, you know, when we start a project to when we finish constructing a project, have changed significantly. I mean, we look at things now like we look at resiliency, we look at sustainability, we look at, you know, life cycle costs. These are all things that, you know, when I started in the industry 25 years ago, we didn't even talk about them. So, I mean, there's definitely been a huge change in how we design, operate, and maintain the roadway system. And so it's had a tremendous benefit, the life cycle analysis that we do now to determine, you know, how much is it going to cost to maintain a road going forward. It's not just the initial cost. It's how much do we need to overlay, you know, over the life of this pavement or the life of this bridge, you know, what's it going to cost? And it really helps the owners of those facilities determine, you know, how much they need to spend up front, how much they need to budget going forward to keep that road in serviceable condition.
You talked about capacity earlier, and ultimately, we don't want to pave paradise. We don't want to put up more roads, more lanes. Is there a tipping point, even for the American Society of Civil Engineers, where there should be other options for transportation, that roads should not have to bear the brunt of that they do?
Absolutely. You know, if you look at things, especially in today's society with the computers we have and the internet and stuff like that, you know, the telecommunication, you know, the way people can, you know, telecommute or, you know, shift hours or, you know, do things like that. And a lot of bigger cities do have, you know, congestion pricing where, you know, you pay a premium to use the left lane or whatever.
The faster lane.
Yeah, the faster mm-hmm. lanes. You know, you pay a premium to use that during rush hour. And so a lot of places are going to that because, like you say, they can't add any more lanes. You know, we're tapped out on how much we can pave.
Because the more we pave, the more we have to maintain.
Absolutely.
And the same with bridges. Now, how much at a disadvantage are more rural areas than more urban areas when it comes to repair and upkeep and that sort of thing?
Well, there's a big disadvantage. If you look at the rural counties in Ohio, there's 88 counties. Most of the counties in Ohio are funded. Their capital improvement project is funded through the gas tax, and all the counties get the same share of the gas tax, and then by their license plate fees. And so, if you think about a smaller county that has maybe 50,000 residents, that license plate fee doesn't match, say, Franklin County. So they have a much smaller capital improvement program to start with. And then when you talk about getting some funding from the federal government, you know, if you get a federal grant to build something, that's going to pay 80% of the project. You have to come up with 20%. So if you have $1 million bridge replacement, the local county has to come up with $200,000, which in some cases that could be more than their yearly budget. And so it's a huge problem for the, for a lot of the rural counties to be able to operate and maintain, you know, their existing system.
What's the standard for prioritizing which projects to go for first? Is there a rule about that, or is it just up to the counties?
It's up to the counties, but there is a rule, and there's a scoring system that they use based on the capacity of the facility, the structural capacity of the say a bridge. So they'll rate the structures, and then basically it goes into a system and a database, and the state comes up with a prioritization to say, okay, these are the 10 bridges we need to look at because they have the lowest ratings, and that's basically how it goes. Now, some projects can move up depending on if they're able to be built quickly. A lot of projects can linger because, like I said, the counties don't have that 20% that they need to match, and so it becomes a problem where you've got these low-rated bridges, but there's just not funding in place, then the locals can't match that money that they need to.
Issue 1 on the March 6th ballot would authorize the state to borrow an additional $1.87 billion in general obligation bonds. That's over a decade to pay for public works projects. And if it's approved, that would be an expansion of the current program, which was approved in 2005, and that was supposed to last 10 years. Why wasn't that enough? Are we asking voters to approve enough money at the outset? And this would increase to $2 billion right. In 5 years.
Yeah, and we should be very clear here that this is not a tax. This is a bond issue.
Right.
So it's not going to increase anybody's taxes, and it's got bipartisan support.
But it does raise the state does have a limit on how much it can borrow.
That's correct.
And
this is a constitutional
amendment. It's approaching
amendment.
The limit. Right.
Basically, what's happening is you've got the revenue sources for transportation funding are stagnant. If you think about the gas tax, the national gas tax hasn't increased since 1993. Mm-hmm. So if you imagine trying to live in today's society on your 1993 pay scale and not having a raise since then, that's what we're doing. We're basically saying we need to operate and maintain our roadways based on our 1993 pay in 2014. And it's just not sustainable. And so things like this, issue one, increase some of the funding available that would allow the state and local government agencies to operate and build more infrastructure projects.
Are we spending enough on improvements as we go along, or do we wait too long and then they start stacking up because we want to build that new bypass or that new bridge?
Yes, there's definitely a dearth in maintenance. Now, I think there's been
it's not as sexy.
No, absolutely not. But there's has been a shift in, say, the last 5 or 10 years. A lot of government agencies are seeing the benefit of putting money into maintenance, because if you just wait until a facility is in poor condition or critical condition, you have to go back and start from scratch. But if you put some money into it as you go along, you can maintain and let the project live a lot longer.
Are Ohio motorists in any danger when they cross the bridges? And any of these bridges that are the C minus is a grade, it's an average grade. Some bridges and roads are worse than others. Are we in any danger like we've seen other people fall to in other states?
Right. Well, and just locally, I think in Fairfield County a couple weeks ago, there was a bridge collapse because of some issues down there. In general, no. I mean, I don't want to scare everybody and say, yes, don't drive anymore. But no, engineers do a very, very diligent job in inspecting the bridges and doing a load rating every year on what the bridges can carry. And the county engineers do a yeoman's job in posting those. So if you drive across a rural bridge, often you'll see a weight reduction on those bridges. And that's basically saying that this bridge is structurally deficient. It doesn't meet the criteria that it should. So we've reduced the amount of weight that can cross over it. So we take all the steps we can to let the public know what the shape of these bridges are. But if a bridge gets to a certain point, the engineer, the county engineer or the state or whoever operates and maintains that bridge will close it if it actually reaches that point. Now, we try and avoid that, obviously, because it's going to affect the traveling community. But I think we do a really good job as engineers keeping the system you know, moving and keeping it open as much as we can, because obviously any time you close something, it's going to create havoc and more problems.
Kevin Carpenter, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Kevin Carpenter of Carpenter Marty Transportation. He also serves on the Board of Zoning and Planning for the City of Upper Arlington. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about the state of Ohio's roads and bridges, and we'll get a closer, take a closer look at the national system of how we fund them. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. On a recent National Roads and Bridges report card, Ohio scored a C-, just a bit better than the D-plus awarded the nation overall by the American Society of Civil Engineers. Neither grade is anything to brag about, of course. And joining us now from the Brookings Institute's Metropolitan Policy Program is researcher Joseph Kane. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Nice to be here.
How do you describe national infrastructure policy?
Well, I mean, I think when anyone talks about infrastructure, you know, it touches many different areas, whether we're talking about roads and bridges, even energy facilities, water facilities. So when we're talking about infrastructure, we're really talking about a broad network of physical assets that require, you know, constant investment and maintenance, and that obviously includes bridges and roads at the state level, at the metropolitan and local level. And at the federal level, including our interstate highways.
So in general, if we break out roads and bridges, what is the national policy? What's the ultimate goal?
Well, I think the goal is to keep everything in a state of good repair. But I think, you know, we're seeing more in Washington and even at the metropolitan level, which I've been looking at in my work. Mm-hmm. It's looking at not so much infrastructure for infrastructure's sake, but more infrastructure for economic competitiveness. So in other words, can we arrive to work on time? Are our roads and our ports and our inland waterways able to facilitate commerce, trade, and logistics? You know, we're currently looking at a national freight strategy. You know, are we really ultimately at the end of the day having the physical facilities to support our national economy?
People often think just about roads and bridges because that's what they see mostly, at least here in the Midwest. We don't have the mass transit that they do on the coasts and in, of course, Chicago. To what extent are we bound by roads and bridges in this country as far as policy goes?
Well, I mean, I think in certainly the latter half of the 20th century, I mean, just the nature of urban development was focused on the interstate highway system. And it really, in many ways, it's a sort of a double-edged sword, right? I mean, it's given us tremendous advantages, not really seen elsewhere, you know, across the world. I mean, at one point, we really were the envy of the world for our infrastructure. And I'm sure, as you've probably discussed already, you know, unfortunately, we're kind of losing speed there, just because we're not able to adequately finance and repair that infrastructure. And, you know, I think roads and bridges are an important part of that. And I don't think it's necessarily an exclusive issue to the Midwest. I mean, when we look at the number of miles that travelers are covering, especially in the Northeast Corridor and on the West Coast, you know, regardless of transit, mobility, and access, you know, we're still using and relying on our roads tremendously. And what a lot of people don't really talk about too much is it's obviously passenger traffic is substantial, but trucks as well are using our interstates tremendously to move our goods to market. And that's a big case in the Midwest, in addition to, obviously, in Ohio, freight railroads are also very important. So it's really this multimodal network, I think, as much as roads and bridges continue to serve a lead role.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Joe Kane. He's a transportation researcher from the Brookings Institute's Metropolitan Policy Program. We're talking about the state of the nation's roads and bridges. particularly in Ohio this hour. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So as far as policy goes, it seems like in Ohio, there's a much more emphasis on the roads and the bridges and not on mass transit. Where does that come from? Why is it that way in the United States?
Well, I mean, I think if you compare it to Europe, just by the nature of its urban structure, I would say, I mean, you're obviously gonna rely more on mass transit with a higher population concentration, and just by the nature of development in Ohio and the Midwest, and less so, I would say, in the Northeast and the West Coast, you'll see a lot more reliance on roads, at least for daily commuting and whatnot. But I mean, I think, you know, at a national level, policy-wise, I mean, I think the goal would be to rely not only on roads and make sure that they're in a state of good repair and people can use them effectively on a daily basis, but that there are other modes that we can use as well to fulfill our needs and to ultimately, you know, support our economy. And I mean, just for my work, I mean, that's particularly true at the metropolitan level, whether you're talking about Columbus or New York. You know, it's as much as I think we like to see ourselves differently, I mean, I think the issues are really much the same. I mean, we have to prioritize infrastructure. I mean, these are pressing challenges that simply can't wait. And, you know, I mean, we're receiving failing grades across the board, and not only roads and bridges, but also in transit. I think we received nationally a D in transit, according to the ASC's most recent report card.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I think we really have to take sort of this comprehensive view, regardless of wherever you're located.
It seems like as long as I've been covering it for the last 25 years, that's been the case.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any point when there's been a real turnaround or an effort to change things dramatically, or is it spitting in the wind at this point?
Well, I mean, I think we can always talk about, well, we need over $3 trillion in investment by 2020, I believe,
right,
is the figure. And of that $3 trillion, I think it's $1.7 trillion just for surface transportation alone. And I think we only have about $870 billion to cover just that surface transportation.
And that's right now in today's dollars. 10 years
correct
down the road, it'll be more.
Correct. But, I mean, you know, with the looming crisis, so to speak, with the Highway Trust Fund, which is basically the main source that pays for our roads and bridges throughout the country, where it's going to be reaching insolvency very likely in August, a lot of these projects are going to be stalled or delayed or just not even happening whatsoever. But I think, you know, the larger focus that we're finding is there is really no silver bullet to solve these problems. There's obvious dysfunction in Washington. But I think it's going to be, you know, a larger sort of comprehensive strategy that ultimately I think is bubbling up at the state and metropolitan level. And, you know, in many ways, whether you're in Ohio, Kentucky, Indiana, Pennsylvania, or elsewhere, you know, states and localities are really kind of having no choice but to take matters into their own hands, while Washington kind of, you know, proposes solutions, but nothing can really get off the ground. And when you think of infrastructure, I mean, it's about as bipartisan, I would imagine, as you can get. I mean, we literally can't function on a daily basis without having good roads, good bridges, good ports. And if we can't even fund that, I mean, you know, we have to sort of ask ourselves, well, where are these solutions going to come from? And I think we're starting to see more of that at the state and local level.
Yeah, about six out of every $10 spent in Ohio on roads and bridges comes from the Federal Highway Trust Fund, and that relies on gas taxes, and that's not doing too well, which is why it's headed toward insolvency.
That's right, yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure some people already know, I mean, the federal gas tax hasn't been raised in over 20 years, I believe, since 1993.
Right.
It's only 18 cents on the gallon. Of course, states have their own gas taxes. I believe Ohio last raised its gas tax, I want to say, 7 years ago or so. But some states, you know, haven't raised their gas tax in over 25 years. And that includes, you know, states like Mississippi and Iowa. But then you have states like Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and Maryland that have increased their gas taxes just in the past couple years alone. So, you know, we can kind of see that a lot can depend on, well, what is the initiative within the states themselves? Are they willing to sort of take on this extra cost to cover, to really cover these necessary expenses? And, You know, I mean, part of it is probably political will. I mean, I think increasing the federal gas tax is really, there is no political appetite for that, just considering we're coming out of a deep recession. And it's probably very much dead on arrival, despite the fact that we see constant proposals talking about that. So, I mean, I think, you know, looking beyond the gas tax, we need to consider other solutions that are out there, whether it's user-based fees, increased tolling, or what we're particularly finding, and this is more, again, at the state and local level, we're seeing more of a public-private partnership to fund these projects. So, in other words, if the public cannot support these projects and public spending has increased or has decreased substantially for infrastructure over the past several decades, you know, is the private sector potentially an option to consider if they're willing to shoulder some of the burden? And we're finding, you know, through partnerships in Chicago, New York, Milwaukee, and so on, it's throughout the country, that if states and localities are partnering with private sector partners, essentially, I mean, they can actually get projects done.
Phil in Columbus, you're on the air with Joe Kane from the Brookings Institute. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to bring up the idea that some of these infrastructure costs overlap in ways that we don't normally allow them to overlap when we talk about what the costs are. And I would reference a show that we had a year or so ago talking about coal versus alternative energy production. And the representative from the coal industry was talking about the high costs that solar and wind have because they require new grids to be built, to new lines to transport the energy from the site of generation to the point of use. And how, in her case, she said that the coal-fired power plants are built right next to the cities. But she didn't mention then how the coal actually gets to the power plants from the mine. And that cost was left off so that there would be roads and railways and things that have to be maintained, and it's not part of the discussion. So, in essence, a truck full of coal is a truck full of energy in the same way if the energy is moving on a power line. So I wonder if you can talk about how we can separate those out and actually define what the real costs are for some of these things that we use.
As we make our priorities, right. Okay.
Yeah, thank
Phil,
you.
Thank you. Joe Kane?
No, it's an excellent point. I mean, I think too often, again, when we talk about infrastructure, I think most people just colloquially just think of, well, it's roads and bridges, right? Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of invisible infrastructure that, you know, we use on a daily basis that really only makes its appearance during maybe an extreme weather event such as Hurricane Sandy or a tornado or whatever. And when we lose our electricity or when we lose access to water, then we kind of realize, oh my gosh, you know, there's sort of this vital network underpinning what we're able to do every day. And, you know, I think it's a great point. I mean, I think too often we look at infrastructure more in this almost cartoonish way where we consider just roads and bridges, and we talk about good jobs and resulting from investment in those assets. But at the end of the day, I mean, we're really talking about a larger network here, whether it's water, energy, pipelines, public works. And each of those sectors of infrastructure has different needs, different distribution systems, different permitting issues, different maintenance requirements. And, you know, we really, given the persistent federal gridlock, and budget constraints, in particular at a state and local level, we need to get more specific in how we address these challenges.
Taxes, they keep cutting taxes in Ohio. You're right, the issue of raising the gas tax doesn't seem to be on the plate anytime soon. So one of the reasons for lower taxes is to attract industry, to attract commerce, to attract companies to the state of Ohio to do business here. To what extent does an insufficient infrastructure, including all of the things that are unseen, affect companies when they decide to when they're looking at different states to locate jobs?
Well, it's a huge issue. I think too often, you know, it's very easy for people to consider sort of, you know, infrastructure in its own space, right? Mm-hmm. If we invest in roads and bridges, we invest in pipelines and transmission lines and water systems, you know, that's great. We're sort of providing a public good for consumers to use. But But really, I mean, infrastructure is inextricably tied to our economy. You know, we don't have access, particularly on the freight side of things, if we don't have access to intermodal distribution centers, you know, the Ohio River is an excellent example. There's tremendous traffic there. The freight railroads, which are obviously maintained pretty well because they're privately owned, you know, those are all vital assets that, beyond just taxation, are important to get business done, you know, every day, whether you're in Ohio, Illinois, and so on. And, you know, at a national level, we're certainly, I would say, considering these issues. But at the end of the day, you know, how are we making sure that we have the financial backing to support all these facilities to conduct business and really ultimately to boost our economy?
Is there a model metropolitan area, in your opinion, that is working hard and spending what they need to be spending now to make sure that the systems are in place going into the future?
Sure. I mean, I think you can you can point to so many different examples because there's hundreds
makes me feel a lot better
in the country.
right,
which is a good thing, right? I mean, I think, you know, we kind of point to the failing grades and say, oh, you know,
right,
doomsday sort of scenario. But there is a lot of good work being done on the ground. You know, we like to talk not only about metropolitan areas. I know, you know, Portland, Oregon is kind of a prime example of getting work done, not only in terms of transit, but then also its ports. And in terms of trade and logistics, Minneapolis is another example where they've had good planning behind their sort of transportation improvements. I think I mentioned Chicago earlier. You know, so there are areas stepping up and taking the lead in this respect. But even at the state level, you know, Virginia has a dedicated what we call a PPP unit, which coordinates these public-private investments, where they've been able to get projects done on the ground. So, you know, if our federal government isn't able to sort of hone in on these priorities and get the job done, we are seeing sort of these can-do states and metropolitan areas making the needed investments, making the needed planning to invest in our infrastructure.
It seems like it's creating a bigger gap, though, between the haves and the have-nots, too, though.
That's right. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of it is, you know, do you have the political will, the leadership, the partners in the region? You know, it's not just a public sector decision. You know, it really needs to be a cross-sector, public, private, nonprofit, philanthropic decision. You know, I think Atlanta is probably a good example in a way of, I mean, they had that snowstorm, I believe, a couple months ago where several people were stranded. You know, that's more emergency response or just the inability to deal with the snow in the South. But, you know, about 2 years ago, they had a decision to make of whether they wanted a 1 cent tax increase to fund additional transportation projects. And that was struck down by voters. And so, you know, it kind of goes both ways. You know, whether, you know, you have the political appetite and, you know, the ability to get these projects done. But, I mean, one thing is clear is that one way or another, they cannot wait.
My guest, Joe Kane, he's a transportation researcher from the Brookings Institute's Metropolitan Policy Program. He'll stay with us as we continue our conversation about the state of our roads, our bridges, and other infrastructure in the nation and in Ohio. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Ohio's construction season is now underway. You might have noticed it this morning. Every morning and afternoon, commuters across central Ohio experience firsthand the construction intended to ease their commute. For now, that means a slower trip for many. But it's necessary and way behind, according to those who study and plan our national and state roads, bridges, and other public works projects. Still with us is Joe Kane from the Brookings Institute. Joining us now is the Director of Transportation and Funding for the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission, Nick Gill. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Ohio gets a C- on its roads and bridges. How does Central Ohio fit into that calculation?
Yeah, I think Central Ohio does fairly well. We've got a fairly good system of freeways, and that ODOT maintains very well. The locals are very proactive in maintaining the system. As you recall, earlier this spring, City of Columbus has a record amount of funding they're spending on their resurfacing program to improve their streets and alleys throughout the City of Columbus. So I think we're doing fairly well. I think part of the advantage we've had is we've been a growing area. There's been a lot of new construction, new roadways built as the growth has occurred over the last few decades. And so that's helped us probably be a little bit better on that grade than the state as a whole.
How important is it to a place like Central Ohio that there are improvements like the Nelsonville bypass 50 miles away, 60 miles away? Does that matter to us?
It does matter to us. We're in the central part of the state. We're sort of the crossroads of the state. We link to all the other regions. That Nelsonville bypass example is probably more important to southeastern Ohio there, but it does help in central Ohio have commerce in there and help our commuters through there. And it's all part of a system of working. The Nelsonville bypass was the latest a large piece that was accomplished in that link. The Lancaster bypass was completed a decade ago. Mm-hmm. ODOT is currently working on, going to be starting this fall on construction of an interchange at Carroll to get rid of the bottleneck traffic light that occurs on 33. So it's all, you know, one piece of a system to improve the system throughout Central Ohio and connect to other parts of the state.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guests, Joe Kane from the Brookings Institute's Metropolitan Policy Program, and Nick Gill, he's Director of Transportation and Funding for the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Joe Kane, Columbus is a growing area. They always say they'll never finish building it. It's constantly under construction for the last 25 years at least, if not the last 50. Mm-hmm. But there are cities, older cities, that are really struggling. And we were talking about the haves and have-nots. I wanted to try to contrast it a little bit with, say, a place like Detroit. How in the world is Detroit keeping things keeping the roads and bridges up and running while there's this complete opposite situation, the huge decline in population and resources?
Right. I mean, I think Detroit is such a unique case, you know, compared to so many other areas. I mean, the largest municipal bankruptcy in history in the United States. I mean, you can talk about maybe Stockton, California, and some other areas of the country. But, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, you know, Detroit infrastructure is really one of its last remaining physical assets. You know, I know that as part of its bankruptcy process, you know, they were trying to coordinate the selling of its water system with neighboring suburbs and localities to try and raise more money and ultimately to try and have a more successful future in terms of its growth and development. I mean, as much as it's even a shrinking city. I mean, Detroit is it's kind of a unique example, I would say, compared to a lot of other areas. But, I mean, it does still, it is emblematic of some other issues we're seeing nationally, that it needs to maintain its infrastructure to provide the necessary services for its population, wherever they're located. How can they do that in a cost-effective and efficient manner? And, you know, and how can they coordinate those efforts with the state of Michigan, federal partners, private partners? And I think that's all up for debate at the moment as they're finding their way out of the bankruptcy.
So it's a unique situation, no doubt about it. It's very unusual what's happened in Detroit, but it's also a cautionary tale. Nick Gill, when you look at building out the infrastructure in Central Ohio, when the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission thinks about how Ohio is going to look, say, in 50 years, which is, I know what you guys do, how much do you think about how much you're going to have to upkeep this stuff?
Upkeep's a big part of it. When you're looking out at how much entities spend on their funding for maintenance and operation of the facility, the majority of that is just to maintain what's there, to operate the system, to resurface it when it needs. You know, less than a third is spent on actually expanding the system, providing new roadways or adding lanes to the existing roadways.
And we were talking earlier about mass transportation. Mm-hmm. What about the idea of mass transportation in Central Ohio, at least? What do you envision?
that's for the community to decide, really. And thus far, you know, they've haven't embraced yet a vision beyond a bus system at the moment. That's what COTA has been working very hard. The last Central High Transit Authority has been working very hard to sort of regrow and repurpose and refocus on the bus system. And they have an exciting project that's going on right now, their transit system review, on looking at their bus system, how they want to operate it. But another more exciting aspect that's going on is what they're going to be launching later this year is what they call the next gen look. They're going to look at a more of a transit visioning discussion with the community to see how what the community wants to be in terms of a mass transit system and what other things they want to do. They've done some incremental things like improving the bus system. They're looking at a bus rapid transit line along Cleveland Avenue, a project they're working towards. So they're starting to work on that, but they really need, and you know, a lot of discussion today so far has been about the funding and providing the resources to be able to provide something more.
Joe Kane, to what extent are our attitudes about the infrastructure, about roads and bridges, about where we spend our money and how we build out in the future generational? Are there big differences in the generations, or are they pretty similar?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there's obviously competing priorities at all times, right? I mean, I don't know if currently, you know, at least in Washington, we have shown as much initiative as we did even 50 years ago during the Eisenhower administration when we launched the interstate highway system. I mean, we just, these, and you know, it's not even so much that we have to get these huge landmark projects done, whether it's highways, bridges, even high-speed rail is a topic that constantly comes up. You know, I think, you know, there's, you know, this appetite, I think, even just to get incremental projects done, local projects, just to get the shovels into the ground, whether it's to expand roads, to maintain them, or even to expand mass transit. That, you know, I think there is an eagerness and a willingness on the part of certainly the current generation of leaders and policymakers to get some of these projects done. But, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if we have the financial capability or the innovative measures in mind yet to really launch sort of these broad sweeping national changes that need to occur.
Tell us about the new highway projects that we're going to be seeing this year in Central Ohio that are critical, Nick, Gil. What are the most important ones to MORPC?
Well, I think the most important ones to the region are some of the ones that are already under construction right now. You know, the downtown projects, the 670 piece of that was, it's basically wrapped up there to the northeast portion of downtown. They're working on a next phase of that. There's, you know, multiple phases of that that's going to occur over the next decade to really rebuild the downtown and about the south and east pieces of that. The I-71 widening through Delaware and Monroe counties, that's going on right now. It's been going on for the last couple of years as that continues. There's the Rickenbacker East-West connector down in Pickaway County that's opening up that bottom area of the Rickenbacker area and the growth and warehousing and the intermodal facility there. Later this year, the interchange at 270 and 33 in the Dublin area will start construction as well. There's, you know, it's just all kinds of critical projects going on. Those are the freeway projects. Well, where we're focused on as well is the planning, you know, the next phase of projects that's looking out even further and trying to get them in the pipeline and have them ready for when funding becomes available.
Joe Kane, how do cities, this probably sounds like a familiar litany, right?
Mm-hmm.
Cities all
no,
over.
But I mean, it's great. I mean, you know, I think it shows once again, you know, it's easy to kind of bemoan the point of, you know, that we have this sort of this crisis, which, you know, in financing and getting projects done, which is true, you know, at a national level. But I think at the same time, you know, Ohio is even showing itself that it is still getting work done in whatever way it can. And it is scoping out other opportunities in years to come.
We have an email from Gina. She asks, if we put a significant number of more people to work at jobs on America's infrastructure with good incomes, how far would the added federal and state income taxes from these jobs go toward actually paying for this infrastructure? I guess that kind of that circular motion of the money. But Joe Kane, is that something that policymakers think about when they're planning long term?
Well, I think several different ideas are being bounced around at the moment. I mean, I think, you know, beyond just sort of the gas tax, as we talked about, mm-hmm. I mean, I know in the State of the Union and President Obama's proposal, you know, he's talked for corporate tax reform to hopefully potentially fund infrastructure projects. There have been calls for user-based fees based on the number of miles that drivers travel. There have been innovative bond measures, even coming out of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act several years ago, Build America bonds, that provide sort of additional financing channels for states and localities to get projects done. And then, you know, we've talked about sort of a national infrastructure bank. Ohio has a state infrastructure bank that's important to fund different projects, but sort of providing those loan guarantees and other sort of financial vehicles to get projects done. So, I mean, I think, you know, at the end of the day, if we're not going to raise the gas tax or there isn't an appetite to get that done, you know, we need to sort of consider all these different tools and mechanisms on the table at once to really, you know, try to cobble up whatever resources we have to get the project done.
Nick Gill, can you give us some examples of some public-private partnerships within MORPC's purview that have occurred?
I think probably a lot of them are on more the local project level, not the freeway interchange area, but more the local roadways development and projects that occur as areas open up. You know, down in the Rickenbacker area, it was a lot of partnership to get those projects completed in that area. In the New Albany area, there's projects that's going on to help, you know, opening up that area as well. Mm-hmm. Those are all very localized, specific, little smaller projects, smaller scale, not the large freeway stuff. The freeway stuff is still primarily in Central Ohio funded with the state funds and ODOT and the federal funds. Mm-hmm. The 270-33 interchanges, there's the city of Dublin itself has put in a lot of funding to advance that project and providing a lot of funding, probably more than typical, to advance a freeway interchange project like that. You know, another project area is the 270-23 on the north side in the Worthington area. Once again, but it's still being a large freeway project, primarily funded with ODOT funds.
If the Federal Highway Trust Fund goes belly up this summer, like it's predicted it will, it could shut down some projects. Would any of those projects, do you know if any of them, any of the ones underway in Central Ohio would be affected?
The ones that are currently underway, they've been authorized, they've been obligated, they're under contract. They would continue. What would more likely happen is any new projects I would expect to sell in the fall would halt. And that's what they're saying. You know, if nothing is done to Congress to address the things, that the program for next year would basically shut down because they've already committed to paying continuing these projects that are already started. So the gas tax receipts that would be coming in and have to get, you know, reimbursed back to the states would be paying for these projects that are currently under construction.
Joe Kane, it sounds like it'll get fixed, that right about the time they need to be doing something, we'll be starting winter again and the orange cones will come up. So the public will might not be there.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, we're kind of in uncharted territory mm-hmm. for some of this. I mean, we've basically used every piece of duct tape and piece of gum. I think that was what the Secretary of Transportation said the other day, to really kind of hold things together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's likely that probably there will be some, like, general fund transfer, as there has been in the past, to kind of plug the leaks for the Highway Trust Fund into the fall, probably through at least the midterm election. But, you know, at the end of the day, we still need to, beyond just a political appetite, we still need to really come up with concrete solutions.
Joe Kane, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Joseph Kane, he's a transportation researcher from the Brookings Institute's Metropolitan Policy Program. And Nick Gill, thanks for joining us as well today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Nick Gill, he's Director of Transportation and Funding for the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.